"The friggin' telemetry doesn't show shit," Tenney snapped, waving his arms angrily. "At that point, it goes bluey. Just turns into fucking hash. Not worth a thimbleful of piss."
Randolph looked back in his chair. He had seen Tenney in many different moods, but never had the engineer been so crude.
"We need to find the thruster in the wreckage," Tenney said more calmly. "So far, we haven't recovered the nose section."
"So what makes you think..."
"It had to be the thruster. Just at the wrong goddamn instant. Talk about Murphy's Law. If the thruster had fired a couple of seconds earlier or even later, Hannah could have compensated, got the bird back under control. But it had to go right then, right at that fucking microsecond. Put the bird into a dive that nobody could recover from. Heat load, aerodynamic load, goddamn structure broke up."
"And the telemetry went out?" Randolph asked again.
"Yeah. Just went into hash, like it was being jammed or something."
"Jammed?"
"You mean like somebody was jamming the frequency?"
"Yep, just like that." Tenney sunk his chin back onto his hairy forearms.
"Deliberately jamming?"
Tenney's brows went up.
"Deliberately?"
Randolph nodded.
"Jesus Q Christ," Tenney muttered. "You think somebody did it on purpose?"
"You tell me." The engineer sat up straighter.
"If it was deliberate..."
"Sabotage," said Randolph.
"Murder." "Whoever did it would have to know our telemetry codes."
"Could that be done?"
"The thruster's controlled by the flight computer. You'd have to know the whole friggin' computer code, then override it and put in a new command to fire the thruster at that point in time."
"Maybe it wasn't jamming," Randolph suggested. "Maybe it was the new command sent in from an outside source and strong enough to override the existing program."
Tenney looked as if he had just discovered ants crawling over his body. "They'd have to know the whole computer program, all the codes, the time sequence, everything."
"That means it's somebody on the inside. Somebody here."
Shaking his head hard enough to pop vertebrae, Tenney replied, "Nah, it couldn't be. We know everybody here. We've worked with them for years, Dan. None of them would do it, kill Hannah. It couldn't be."
Randolph felt a wave of anger rising in him.
"Somebody here, somebody who's worked for me for years, deliberately sabotaged the space plane, deliberately killed Hannah. Some son of a bitch that I've trusted."
"They wouldn't have to know that the plane was going to crash," he said slowly. "They'd just be selling information to make some extra bucks."
"Corporate espionage," Tenney growled. Keeping his voice calm, flat, Dan asked the engineer,
"Can you come up with a better explanation?"
Tenney swung a leg over the chair he'd been sitting on and got to his feet. "When I do, I'll let you know." He started for the door. Dan saw that both his hands were balled into fists.
"Joe..."
Tenney stopped and turned back toward Randolph. "Keep this between you and me. If we do have a rat in with us, I don't want him to know that we suspect anything."
"Yeah, right."
"Nobody else, Joe. Not even Lynn. And especially not Passo. Just you and me. That's going to slow things down if I have to do all the checking myself."
"Nobody else."
Tenney nodded, accepting it.
"Gotcha."
Washington, D.C.
The Senate dining room was quiet. Only a few tables were occupied this late in the afternoon. The strong aroma of freshly brewed coffee wafted in from the kitchen as Senator Quill toyed with a fruit salad, waiting for Jane Thornton to show up. Robert Quill was a man with an embarrassment of riches. Like most of his fellow senators, he had been born to considerable wealth. His forebears had made the family's original fortune in railroads and steel, and sent their sons to the Wharton School of Business to learn how to preserve the family's money and add to it. They invested in aluminum and aircraft, later in titanium and electronics. Each generation sent one of their sons to the United States Senate. Protecting the fortune was as important as increasing it. Bob Quill was known as a liberal senator. He fought for civil liberties and equal rights, as long as they didn't seriously endanger his family's interests. To his credit, he bent corporate managers and directors, including his own siblings, toward better treatment of minorities, including Native Americans. His biggest political problem was the thick seams of coal deposits that underlay Montana's Great Plains region. For years, Quill had earnestly tried to convince his fellow senators, and even a president or two, that this coal represented an untapped reserve of energy as large as all the oil in the Middle East. But nobody wanted Montana's coal. The environmentalists pointed out that coal, especially the high sulfur content coal in Montana, was an ecological nightmare. Mining it would devastate croplands and pastures. Burning it would pollute the air unconscionably. The oil interests didn't want Montana's coal competing against them. And the automotive industry pointed out that although coal could be converted into liquid fuel for transportation purposes, the cost of doing so was so high that only a national emergency and plenty of federal funds could possibly justify it. Quill was brooding on these matters when Jane Thornton finally arrived at his table. "I'm sorry to be late, Bob," she said softly. People tended to speak in whispers when the dining room was almost empty. "The subcommittee chairman wouldn't let go of us until 5 minutes ago." Quill got to his feet and helped her into a chair. He was a small man, slight and light-boned, almost like a dancer. Despite his Western origins, he dressed like a Philadelphia banker in a dark gray three-piece suit. With his trim mustache and sleekly coiffed silver hair, news reporters almost always described him as dapper. A waiter immediately brought a menu, but Jane waved him off. "I had lunch in my office," she explained to Quill. He smiled at her. Senator Thornton had been his protege since she'd first arrived on Capitol Hill. They had fought battles against the radicals of both the right and the left, and won more times than anyone had a right to expect. The occasional rumors about their being lovers buoyed Quill's ego, even though there was no truth to them. "I've only got a few minutes, Jane," he said apologetically. "I've got to talk on the floor. C-SPAN's covering it." Jane understood. It was common practice to give a speech late in the day to a nearly empty Senate chamber. The voters back home would see their senator on C-SPAN, holding forth on some issue that was important to them. "Energy?" she asked. He shook his head. "Farm price supports." "Oh. Good luck." Quill pushed his half-finished fruit salad away. "So what do you want to tell me?" "I want to ask you something, Bob." He cocked his head slightly to one side.
"Go ahead and ask."
"I want your support for Morgan Scanwell." He smiled.
"I thought so."
"He can win it, Bob," she said earnestly. "With the proper support, he can win the nomination." Quill glanced at his wristwatch. Knowing he could trust Jane Thornton, he said,
"Let's cut to the chase. What can Scanwell do for me?"
"He's thinking about making energy independence a major plank in his platform."
"Western coal?"
"And the high-tech systems that will allow us to use Western coal without ruining the environment."
Quill fell silent for all of 5 seconds. Then, "I'll have to meet him. Talk to him. Size him up."
"You can trust him, Bob."
"I'll still need to press the flesh."
"Yes, of course. I'll tell his people to contact your people."
"Quietly," Quill added. "I don't want anything leaked before I'm ready to make a public statement."
"Quiet as a mouse," Jane said, smiling.
"Quieter," said Senator Quill, completely serious.
Hours after sunset, Senator Thornton was still in her office, talking intently with one of Governor Scanwell's aides in Austin. On her desktop screen, the aide looked no more than a teenager, young and earnest and full of energy. She had a big Texas cheerleader's toothy smile and golden blonde hair. It might even be naturally blonde, Jane thought. The door from the outer office opened, and Denny O'Brien shambled in, looking as if he had rolled all the way from Bethesda, as usual. Jane suppressed a frown and reminded herself that Denny's brain was sharp, even if his outward appearance wasn't, and it was his brain that she depended on. "Very well, then," she said to the smiling aide on the desktop screen. "I'll leave it to you to contact Senator Quill's office."
"Oh, yes, ma'am, Senator Thornton. I'll get on the horn right away," gushed the aide.
"Good, thank you." Jane cut the connection and turned to O'Brien, who was rummaging through the refrigerator set into the wall below the bookshelves. "Don't you have a home to go to?" she asked good-naturedly.
"Nope. I sleep in the streets," keeps me closer.